This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Did you ever work with your high school friends?
Welcome to the gallows.
This is Jake. With me, as always, my co-host, Adam.
Yo.
I'd like to say hello to all of our gallows poll out there. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Yo, everybody.
We're going to have Adam go ahead and get kicked off with our PSA.
All right. So visit us at thegallowspodcast.com. From there, you can go to our Facebook, Twitter, and our Patreon. Check out our Patreon website and find our missing episodes, because they're starting to stack up.
They are. We got some good stuff on there.
Yep. You're going to see we're on our website there, thegallowspodcast.com, that there's some gaps. And if you want them, go and sign up and become a member.
That's right. I'll give this little cliffhanger. Last week's episode has a little twist to it.
Little twist.
Little twist that's new to the show.
Yes. So to visit us at our Patreon, go to patreon.com/HarperGuysProduction.
That's right.
You can also visit us everywhere podcasts are found. If you have questions, comments, or case ideas, please email us at thegallowspod@gmail.com.
Perfect. Well, to get started tonight, let's go just a little bit. Not a whole lot going on in the world of execution this week. There have really been no huge developments in any states with anything that's going on. We still have tons of people that I'm not going to get into that have stays and reprieves right now as we work through COVID. As you guys know, there have been several federal cases that have moved forward. There are also some state cases that have moved forward to where we're not grinding to a complete halt here, but there are a lot of places that are on furlough right now. So the only two that are really coming up in any kind of the near distant future is 1 month from today is still Keith Wayne Dawson, and he is the last of the four federals that's going to be executed right now.
Just kill him already.
Well, they got a timeline on all this stuff, so you can't do them all on one day.
I'm anxious.
And then a couple weeks later in Texas, we got John Ramirez. And then after that, it's a who's who guess of what's actually going to go on. There's a couple that are scheduled in October. I think there's actually four or five right now, depending on how the one case went. So we'll find that out a little bit closer as we get the time.
Maybe we give that guy Ramirez a stay and see if he can play some ball.
Yeah. I mean.
Sorry.
I don't know. Maybe play short. Right? It's hard to say. So tonight's story starts on April the 15th, 1994. After a long week of school and the work that goes after it for a lot of high school kids, a couple friends from Gadsden, Alabama, their names are Brian Archer and Nathaniel Baker. And I thought that the Baker was neat because you got a Baker that you're pretty close to. So
yep.
I think it's the first Baker that we've had on the show.
Plus, we work with a Baker.
That's right. We do work with a Baker.
Well, we did.
Right. So after school, they have just a little bit of time and then they get ready and they head to work at Popeye's where they work together. You know, a little Popeye's chicken. I don't know if you've ever had Popeye's chicken. Popeye's chicken is delicious, right?
It's good.
So they were closing that night together. And if you've ever worked in the world of fast food, you know that the closing shift, like there's people that work like mid shifts and get out at 7, 8, 9 o'clock, somewhere around in there. Well, these guys, when they worked together, they didn't mind taking their closing shifts together. You know, when it comes to cleaning up and getting out of there, it's best to have somebody that you're close to, that you're cool with. You know, if not, you can get really frustrated. It can be a long thing. If you're ready to get out of there and somebody's dawdling, you know, to where teamwork makes a dream work, right? To where
sure.
This wasn't uncommon for them to be together like that. Well, They also had been kind of looking forward to meeting their new general manager, a guy named Daryl Collier. And he was actually the new general manager. This was his first day on the job, right? And then we also had Tamika Collins, who was there. Now, she's the assistant manager. And they like to kind of give her a hard time because she was one of those people that was really, it wasn't, not like in a bad way, but like you could tease her a little bit. And she was one of those people that was very by the book. You know, like, these are what our practices and procedures are. This is how we do this stuff. And she really did lead by example. From everybody that I talked to, like, she was one of these people that she just led everything by example all the time when she was working in this role, right? And if you messed up, she's going to let you know that you messed it up, you know? And Daryl and Tamika had actually already met, you know? They met at another branch just to make sure that they got to know each other because they're kind of the managerial staff here, right? Well, Daryl was really, really good, but with her being the way she was. He liked having somebody assertive as an assistant manager to where he felt like that kind of freed him up to do his job a little bit. And he was one of these people, very, very intelligent guy. He's acutely aware of his surroundings, right? What he's walking into. He, as the personality, he grew up coming through Popeyes. He started off as a dishwasher, you know, all the way through to where one of the things that he does to build rapport with his teams is he comes in, he'll wash dishes. He's helping out in the front. I mean, he's all over the place. He's the last one out of the building. He closes a lot of nights to where a lot of GMs don't close.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, they just don't. They work a midday shift, so they get their Friday evening together just like everybody else
but
does.
But you know what? This guy's commanding respect right now.
Exactly. Especially when you move into a new environment, you know, new employees. You got to make that work that way, you know? And this is something he'd worked so hard for 7 years to get this opportunity. This was the job that he wanted from the day that he hired in there. And it was really a good opportunity for him and his family. You know, anytime you get a big promotion, you know, all it does is help the home life a little bit, right? Might be some initial stress in the beginning.
Sure.
But he was super excited to get to work, you know? So he comes in super proud to work that day and he cruises right through the dinner rush. I mean, immediately his team can see this guy's a pro. You know, the kitchen gets super busy at one point in time. The drive-through at one point in time got pretty backed up. He's jumping on headsets, doing everything you can ever ask for, you know? And he always told his employees, you know, the better that we do with all this kind of stuff, we're going to create happy, loyal customers. That's what everybody wants, right? Well, about the same time that dinner was winding down, you got Tamika, who's on her normal staff schedule all the time. And about 8:30 is a lot of times when you see the faster food restaurants like this start cutting staff in the evenings. Well, it's a really common practice in the restaurant business like this because when the building stops producing massive amounts of money per hour, you start cutting overhead per hour, right? That keeps your cost under control.
Makes sense.
Helps profitability, right?
Hell yeah.
Well, this brings us to about 11:30, and they're the last four that are left, right? We got Daryl and Tamika and the two buddies, right? So they're finishing up. They close at 11, so we're about a half hour in. He's trying to help them get out of there as quick as possible. So we got Tamika out in the dining room. She's refilling the stuff that needs refilled out there, you know, salt, sugar, doing those kind of things, making sure everything's cleaned up out there. And Brian's over working on the dishes. So Nathaniel and Daryl actually head out to the back to take the trash out. As the manager in charge of the building, Daryl actually has to unlock the back door so that they're able to take the trash cans out, right? Because after hours, not just anybody can go in and out. If you were just walk out without having the actual key to the building, you're not going to be able to get back in.
Makes sense to me.
I mean, even back in 1994, this stuff automatically locked up.
Oh, sure.
Right? So they get out there. They got the big trash bin. I don't know if you've ever seen these that are like on the other side of the parking lot because they don't want the trash sitting right beside the building.
Well, some of it does, though, and they build the little box around it. But anyways.
Right. So they get the trash unloaded. They head back to the building. And as they're about 10 steps from the door, two men step around the corner of the building. And they both have handguns that you can see. One of the men is wearing a mask, like a kind of described as a ski mask, but it was like multicolored. And they said he had a really deep voice. And the second man was quite a bit smaller in stature, and his voice sounded a bit younger. You know how like you get that late teen kind of voice to where you could tell that you've gone through puberty, but it's not that deep baritone man voice, you know, that that comes out as you get older. The other thing about the second guy, the younger guy, is that he had a pair of sunglasses on and he had his hoodie pulled like real tight to the sunglasses. Like kind of reminded me of like Kenny from South Park, you know, like when you pull him real tight.
Yeah.
So instead of actually taking the time to get a mask for this heist, he decides that he's just going to pull his hoodie real, real tight.
I got shades and a hoodie. I'm good.
I mean, that's what I thought. I was like, that's.
No, I got shades and a hoodie. I'm good.
Right. Underwhelming to say the least. So they take him back in and they demand the cash from the cash register. Right. So Bryant is actually off to the one side. So imagine that they come in from like what would be the back left of the building. Bryant is working on the right side wall. So he hears the door close and he catches him out of the corner of his eye and he sees his friend and his boss being forced into the office, you know, to where there's kind of a minute of panic that sets in here with him, right?
Sure.
Well, within a matter of seconds, the older guy with the deeper voice, he demanded everybody left in the building to get into the office or he was going to start shooting. So Tamika comes around the corner. She goes in, does as she's told. Bryant stops washing dishes. He walks in, does what he's told. So they get in there. All the money for the night's already been put in the safe, right? So they said, well, open the safe. So Daryl gets down there and tries to open the safe. For all of his composure, he's a little bit rattled at this point, and he fails on the first attempt. Well, immediately, Tamika jumps into action. Didn't even, according to the reports, there wasn't even anybody yelling about anything. Like, instantly, as soon as he missed it, she's like, I got this. She jumps right in, boom, 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 gets it opened up, hands them the cash. $2,100, which, for a fast food night in 1994, that's a pretty busy night.
That's a big night, I mean, in my opinion.
Right. I mean, if you have a lunch that's even comparable to that, you're talking about some pretty serious coin flowing through a building over the course of a year, right? So with the money in hand, they said, you know, let's just put them in the freezer, right? We can lock them in the freezer. Somebody will eventually find them, right? So they push all four people inside and the door was locked. Well, what they don't know at this point in time is there's actually a push button inside. These actually became mandatory, I think, back in the mid-80s after there were a couple accidents. I'm sure you've heard of like the old refrigerators that like kids have got stuck in, stuff like that.
Yeah.
To where anything that's a commercialized freezer like this is always going to have this button in there someplace.
Just got to wait a little bit. You don't want to push it too early.
Correct. So they all go in and Bryant actually sits down on a 5-gallon bucket and he's facing the other three and they're standing there talking. And while this is going on, they are just trying to collect themselves and come up with a plan. How long do we want to wait? What's going to go on? All of a sudden, the door opens back up and shots just start ringing out like crazy. Nathaniel gets hit twice. Daryl gets hit 3 times. Tamika gets hit twice. And then Bryant, who was actually the closest one and like at point blank range right in front of him, gets hit 5 times. They would determine that there were actually 19 shots fired and 12 of those 19 shots hit these four people.
Holy shit.
They also estimated that this lasted less than 15 seconds, which probably seemed like an eternity. I mean, 15 seconds. I mean, you know how fast you can squeeze the trigger on a gun. I mean, there's a little bit of aiming, but not much going on in that period of time.
That's unreal.
I mean,
that's a lot.
It's just a complete massacre is what it is. So the way that it worked out is basically it was described that there was just a pile of bodies laying on the floor. So next thing you know, the door closes again, and the only sound that's left, and this kind of gave me like the heebie-jeebies a little bit, it was like the only sound that could be heard anywhere throughout was the refrigerator's motor. Like, you ever heard the motor on a freezer, how it's kind of loud?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just humming along. Well, after about 30 seconds after the door closes the second time, it was Bryant who all of a sudden gets this jolt of adrenaline run through his body.
The guy that got hit 5 times.
5 times. He knows he's badly hurt. But at this point in time, he doesn't really understand to what extent he's injured. He thinks about it for a second, and then he reaches for the button to unlock the freezer door. And he knows in this moment that if those guys are still in there rummaging through stuff, they're going to finish him off. But he also has this overwhelming feeling that this is his only chance, right? To where if he doesn't do this now, he might not have a chance. If he passes out, it's all over, right? So he opens up the door, and he looks out with just his right eye. That's important because at this point he can't see out of his left eye because he was literally shot directly in his left eye with one of those shots.
How is he even standing?
Right? So he tries to listen and all he hears at this point is just his ears ringing, right? To where he couldn't make out any sounds, but he didn't see any movement either. So he makes a beeline to the office because he knew that that's where the only phone is at in the building, right? As he walks, he starts to realize that his left eye really isn't working and he can feel blood starting to run down his face. He then also realizes that there's blood running out of his right arm, his right leg, and his stomach, where he actually had 2 shots in. So he finally makes this 30-foot journey to get in, and he was actually able to dial 911. He gives the operator the address and tells him, hey, my legs are going to be sticking out of the office door so you know that it's me because I feel like I'm going to pass back out. And I don't want somebody to get coming in and thinking that it's me that was actually doing anything that's in here, you know? tells him what's going on, what's happening. Three of his friends are in the freezer. So before laying his head down on the cool office floor, he told the operator one more thing. He said one of the two men was a fellow student of ours at Gadsden High School, and his name is Henrique Periotta, and he was actually fired last month from working here. So immediately, to me, it sounds like we got a disgruntled employee, right?
Henrique. What a doucher.
Yeah, he actually would go by Ricky. So that's what he'll be referred to as for the rest of the show, instead of trying to say Ricky's not a good guy.
No wonder he got fired, asshole.
Right? So EMS and police arrive on the scene within 6 minutes and begin to assess the situation. Brian is taken to the hospital immediately and into emergency surgery. Daryl, Nathaniel, and Tamika are all pronounced dead at the scene from their injuries.
Fatal.
All three of them had actually taken headshots.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So police put out an APB for Ricky's car. And within 1 hour, they locate the vehicle on Country Road 77, and they're heading south. So the initial officer who follows the car just gets behind him. And he waits. You know, he's got radio transmissions going on. Another cop comes up behind him, right? To where now we got two cops on scene, and they're getting ready to pull him over, and they get a quick call, and they're like, hey, there's another cop that's just about ready to join this too. Hold on 1 second. Well, this other cop, hauling tail down the road, actually is able to cut them off. He comes off of a road called Sutton Bridge Road and cuts off in front of them. So now you have a car in the front and two in the back, right? But within a few seconds, the lead officer tells the other two, hey, throw your lights on. The guy that's the lead car in the back pulls up to the side, gun drawn, like just waiting. I mean, because if somebody comes out firing, he's going to have to return fire, right? Front car slows down. They box him in. They drive him right off the side of the road. So they're stopped off to the side of the road. Immediately, the passenger takes both hands and sticks them out the right side of the window, right? And according to the report, as the first officer approaches the car, you know, telling them, hands out the window, screaming at him like that, he actually hears the passenger look at Ricky and say, what did you do? So that would kind of become key a little bit later on. So Ricky was 18 at the time, and Robert Nelson was the other gentleman that was in the car with him. Nelson's 22, right? Now, it's one of these things where they're 4 years apart, but they're friends kind of through friends. You know, they weren't the best of friends, but they became decent friends over the years. You know, they've had some people that were mutual to where it kind of worked out. So they get them both. They take them down to the station for questioning. Now, Nelson is a pretty stout guy. He's right about 6 foot tall, about 220 pounds, pretty athletic build on him. He's a pretty imposing guy when you look at pictures of him, right? And they start questioning him. He's like, I have no idea what's going on. I was at home sleeping. Ricky showed up, and we were going to go shoot pool, and that was about 30 minutes before you guys pulled me over. Well, his alibi couldn't be corroborated by anybody because nobody was home. His wife and his daughter were already gone for the day, right? So he doesn't have that on his side, but it does look good for him that he only lives 15 minutes away, right? So it makes the whole half hour scenario seem pretty logical. He shows up at your house, you got to get ready and stuff. You're going to go out and shoot the pool. Now this time it's midnight, 12:15, somewhere around in there. I've gone and played pool late at night before. So to me, it didn't sound completely crazy.
Sure.
Right. So while they're doing the investigation of these guys and they're doing the questioning, they start looking into their backgrounds. Like, who do we really have here? What's going on? Right. So when it comes to Nelson, when he was 17, he had an assault, and that happened at a party that he was at. Right. And when he was 18, and it was like the night of his 18th birthday, he got caught with a petty theft. It sounds like it was something stupid that he took from like a gas station. You know what I mean? To where he was drunk, celebrating his birthday. I mean, you shouldn't be drunk at 18 celebrating your birthday, but it is what it is, right?
To where, well, if you're drunk at 18, you're probably going to go steal something.
Right. To where it wasn't somebody that had like a jaded criminal background, right? So they said, well, you know, what are you and Ricky been doing? You know, he's like, well, I already told you, you know, said I wasn't with Ricky all night. Said Ricky was out hustling, and he thought that meant dealing drugs because Ricky was actually known to sell some drugs around. To where he just assumed that that's what was going on. And he said, hey, you know, he's going to take me to shoot pool, and he's going to pay for pool and pay for drinks and food. I'm not going to turn that down. I mean, that sounds like a fun way to save my night when nobody's at home.
Hey, Ricky, you got some splaining to do.
Exactly. Well, in the next room, there's a whole different story being told. Ricky said that he had cased the restaurant when he worked there and that he used to make jokes about how easy it would be to rob this place. Well, this is actually one of the reasons they got fired. Like, they had this noted on there because multiple employees complained about the fact that he had mentioned this. Like, if you were ever really casing a joint to rob it, would you tell people that's what you're looking at?
Hashtag dumbass.
Right. So he said when he told Nelson about the plan that he was super eager to help as long as he split it with him 50-50. He goes on to say that they chose Friday because Friday is typically a pretty busy night for a fast food joint, but it's not as bad as Saturday, you know, because there's still people that are finishing their work weeks or even at the end of their work week on Friday, they just want to go home and chill out. Saturday nights is when most people are out a lot more. So they thought, you know, we can still get a good haul on a good night without it being that night. So he explains that everything is going along smoothly until they reach the exit. And Nelson actually turns to Ricky and he says, hey, did any of your coworkers recognize you? And Ricky said that he said, no, but maybe. I'm not 100% for sure. So according to Ricky's testimony, Nelson, instead of taking any chances at all, he goes back to the freezer, opens up the door, and unloads the 20-round clip into the door, right? To where he basically pulled it open. That's when all the shots are fired. And there was actually one left stuck in the chamber. That's why there was 19 shots fired instead of 20. And this is actually a really common problem if you're using any kind of a semi-automatic pistol because it will get hot. Chamber gets hot. Sometimes it doesn't discharge correctly. To where that's what they attributed that to. They looked at this as he's being super truthful and something like that. It could only happen in that situation, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's purely circumstantial evidence if there was ever circumstantial evidence. But that looks good to them.
Agreed.
So police decide to go ahead and charge them both with murder based on the story that Ricky had told and then go ahead and continue their investigation. You know, if something changes, they can always go back and change the charges, stuff like that, which I'm not a fan of arresting people like that. I think that that's something that should be wrong. I think if you're going to make an arrest like that, the only way to elevate charges is if you find like some brand new crime that this person also committed that can be added in. You shouldn't be able to just be like, well, we're going to get you for this, but then we're going to see what we can do to build the case here.
I mean, you had the guy that took five shots saying one of these guys is Ricky.
No. Well, saying that it's Ricky, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The guy called dispatch.
Yeah.
And said, hey, one of these guys is Ricky.
Yes. So you know you got one of them.
Right. So you're not sure that the other guy is involved. So at worst, you take Ricky into custody, and then you work on the other guy.
I mean, you would think so, right?
I mean, aren't you
innocent until proven guilty? I actually thought about that phrase as I was researching this and writing this. So they go into investigation mode, right? One of the things that they come up with at trial is that they are able to match a bloody shoe print from the freezer with a shoe print from right where Nelson was standing when they pulled him out of the car and actually arrested him. So they're matching up these two shoes. This shoe is his shoe. He was the one that was in the freezer. That's how they're lining this up at this point, right? Then they checked the .45 that was in the back seat of the car as they searched the car. Sure enough, there's a round that's stuck in the chamber to where they know that part is at least true, that it did misfire at that point, right?
Seems logical.
So they send it off to have some testing done. They find Ricky's fingerprints on it. No surprise at that point. You know, Ricky's car, I'm sure Ricky would have handled it at some point. There's another set of prints on it, but they cannot conclusively identify who has the second set of prints on that gun.
So they don't match the dude in custody.
They don't match and they don't not match. It's almost like an ambiguous piece of evidence that's evidence, but not evidence that it's evidence that somebody else touched the gun, but not necessarily that Nelson did.
You can't have they don't match and they do match. They either don't match or they do match.
Exactly. So just like they had looked into Nelson, they just started to start looking into Ricky, right? Well, they look in his past, multiple robberies, multiple assaults. His record got started at the age of 13, and by the time he was 16, he spent some time in juvie for assault with a deadly weapon involving a gun.
So this
guy has got some inconsistencies going on in his life. You know, he was only here for a robbery, but looking at his past, he's got some violence involved in it too, right? Ricky, at this point in time, after he gives his entire statement, agrees to turn state's evidence on Nelson in exchange for a life sentence. So he took a life sentence for three murders and an attempted murder that he didn't commit. That seems like an awful stiff penalty. I mean, I can understand being afraid of the death penalty, but to take that when you got three murder ones and an attempted murder hanging over your head, to me it seems excessive if I feel like I'm truly innocent, right? So Nelson on the other side said, I can't turn state's evidence against Ricky because I wasn't with him. I have no idea what he was doing before he got to my house. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he didn't. I have no idea. Well, it didn't really matter to the police at this point. So for the next 2 years, there's offers and they have pleas and they actually have a guilty plea at one point in time from Ricky that gets pulled back because they tried to change his deal and the whole thing. The entire time, Nelson continues to say, hey, I didn't have anything to do with this, right? Well, finally in 1996, they get Nelson's trial underway. The shoe evidence is proven to be dubious at best. An expert comes in, right? And he explains how the difference in the wet clay that's actually on the road and continues to get more wet and more changed as time goes on with it raining outside and the wet blood from the freezer actually have very different outcomes when the same shoe is on it. And he proves it with a whole bunch of tests that he shows in the court, right? On top of that, he even shows comparisons of what happens in these two different materials and determines under his expert opinion that the shoe is 1 to 1.5 sizes different than the shoes that Nelson had on when they pulled him over. So the shoe information, nothing.
No good.
No. They also go on to find that there's no gunpowder residue on Nelson anywhere, even though you have Ricky saying that there definitely should be, right? He's got a mask on, even if he's got gloves and a jacket on, around your eyes, because he said that he didn't have any glasses on. So someplace, you're going to have a speck of that on you someplace, well, if you're fine or 45.
Why are we even listening to Ricky anyways? This guy is a bona fide criminal. You don't trust what he has to say.
Correct. And then the final piece that makes this crazy is that Bryant, the survivor of this entire ordeal.
He did survive.
He does survive. In his description, he said that this guy was at a maximum 5'9". And he could not pick out his eyes from a lineup because he said that he saw them very briefly, that he didn't get a good look at him. The other thing, though, because one of the big distinctions that they make in this entire thing is the voices. He could not pick out his voice. They played over 30 voices for him, and he could not pick it out. No, not even close. It didn't happen to where they don't have a positive ID on this guy at all. Well, it's clear at this point that the state of Alabama didn't care about the lack of physical evidence or the fact that they were relying on the memory of a man initially that had been shot 5 times. And the word of a known criminal that is clearly at the scene, right? So in October of 1996, Nelson is actually convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of attempted murder, and 1 count of armed robbery and given a death sentence.
Good God.
Ricky gets 40 to life. The kicker is after all this back and forth, if you're a model citizen, you get out after 20 years. You're talking about him being out of jail before he's 40.
What the fuck is going on here?
Right? Well, lucky for the American public, Ricky ain't the golden child that the state really wants him to be. In 1999, he actually kills another inmate in a fight. And this gets him put on death row. Kind of crazy. In the state of Alabama, they're all in the same death row. His cell, 3 cells down from Nelson's. I mean, tell me that wouldn't just be in your gall every single day, knowing that the guy that put you here is right there.
If as soon as my appeals ran out,
yeah,
I'm Nelson, I'm coming for you, Murdoch.
If there's ever a way, right? So this brings us to 2000, and something strange happens. Ricky comes out in 2000, 1 year after he's put on death row, and he says, I completely fabricated my story. He didn't have anything to do with it. Nelson was never part of any of this plan. He was never on scene for it. I did pick him up just like I said that he did. I had to protect myself and my family from a known gang member that I know is going to harm my family if I give them up. He said, to the end, that I'm not willing to give them up now. If you're going to make me choose between Nelson dying or my family dying, I have to choose Nelson. So this was not a, hey, I was just lying. This is a well thought out, orchestrated conversation that he's actually having here.
Gang related.
That's what he's saying. Okay. Now, I don't know what you think, and I don't know the entire demographic, but I don't think of Gadsden, Alabama, as a hub. Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. I don't really know. It doesn't sound like it by demographic.
But why would he say that, though?
Well, if it's true, maybe. Or if he's trying to get the guy off death row, maybe too. I don't. Maybe he didn't think he was going to get death row for it. I don't know.
Well, how long has he been on death row at this point?
Who? Ricky?
Nelson.
Nelson, at this point, has been on for 4 years.
Ironically, Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
Anyways.
It is true. So this brings us to a strange thing. Alabama is the only state in the union that has the death penalty and does not provide counsel for the appeals process after a decision of execution has been made. The only ones, which I think that's bizarre. So because Nelson had to go out and find anyone he could, he finally finds a lawyer from out of state. And this is when the circus really gets going. I'm not going to go into the details of the rabbit hole that you can go down in this case if you ever want to get into it. I'm talking there are missed deadlines, unsigned briefs, filings with the wrong circuit court, failure to appear, and several other issues that are clearly terrible representation. If any representation at all, to be quite honest. Right?
What, from the new guy out of state?
Yeah. He has nobody that's actually trying to help him with his appeals process, especially in a case like this that looks so fragile for him being the one that did it. You're talking about this much testimony and a shoe print that looks fraudulent point in time.
The lawyer is obviously a drunk and can't get his shit together.
Right. All in all, it takes 23 years to sort this out. And in the end, the state says that there's nothing compelling that would have changed the outcome of the case or the appeals. So even with neglect by counsel, it would not have had an impact on this case. Not a fan of that argument at all. So, well, we fucked it all up, but it wouldn't have changed anything.
You know what the bottom line is? They don't want to have to give this guy millions of dollars to set him free. That's a big deal.
I agree.
I've watched this on many occasion on TV with inmates, and they don't want to. For one, they don't want to say they're wrong.
Right.
For two, they know this guy is going to get millions if he walks.
Well, they basically shoot it all down, and they give him an execution date of 6/8 of 2017. On that day, they actually have the Supreme Court put a temporary hold on the execution. And Justice Clarence Thomas reviews the case, and then they lift it.
Wait, the Clarence Thomas?
The Clarence Thomas reviews this and then lifts it. So, to me...
What does that mean, lifts it?
Go time. Roll on too, buddy.
Really?
Lifts the moratorium. Yep, to where, sorry, buddy, no stay for you no more. It's time for you to go. So,
and this is for Nelson.
This is for Nelson. So this execution goes from mundane to kind of insane when you look at it. And by mundane, I mean this. Nelson refused to see anyone or make any phone calls in the 2 days prior to his execution. On the day of his execution, he refuses breakfast that morning, and he forewent his option to have a final meal prepared. So he skipped the last two meals all the way around. No time with family, anything like that, right? He sat in dead silence in his cell for 15 consecutive hours. They were checking on him constantly because these guys are always on suicide watch, right? Watching him constantly, just sitting there on the bed, 15 hours straight, right? Finally, it's time to take him towards the execution chamber. And once they're in the execution chamber, again, things move very, very quickly. The death warrant is served by the warden, which they have to do, explain to them what's about to happen. They ask Nelson for any final words, and he looks at the warden and says, "No, ma'am." So then the process starts. What we have here is a drug called midazolam, right? So after he says, "No, ma'am," within about 20 seconds, they start to push this. Within about 10 seconds of it starting to get into his vein, Nelson starts to breathe really heavy. And then he starts to wheeze like really, really bad. Like he can't catch his breath. Usually this takes 30 seconds, you know, before you get to a point where somebody is snoring, right? It's a sedative. Well, in this case, it takes 20 minutes before they can get enough of this in him to get this to stop, right? So I'm talking For 20 minutes, this man lays there and thrashes and gasps and twitches and gurgles. I am not one that is soft about the way that these people go out that are real hardened convicted murderers. But if there was ever somebody that deserved a quick death, if you're going to give it to him, based on everything that I read, just be not saying that he didn't do it, but from the option that he clearly might not have, he didn't deserve this. Finally, after 20 minutes, they get enough in him and he gets calmed down and they go ahead and they push the pancuronium bromide. That is the actual full-on paralytic that stops everything from moving. And then they finish with potassium chloride, which stops the heart, right? So all told, this takes 27 minutes to complete. That's a long time for a lethal injection.
20 minutes for the first one and then 7 minutes for the next two.
Right. Now, the other thing that makes this kind of crazy is it actually started at 10:02, right? So it's actually 25 minutes for the entire thing to happen. After 12 minutes of him not succumbing to the first drug, they closed the curtain. And they finally announced afterwards that it took all the way till 10:27 to get here. Well, when the time of death is released, it causes outrage over the length of time that it takes for this to take effect. And because of this actual case, Alabama is trying to finish off the stockpile that it has of this drug, and then they're looking at moving to pentobarbital in 2021. So that is the execution of Mr. Nelson. Clearly a few things to talk about here coming down the stretch at the end. The first question that I have is, should they have ever given Ricky a plea deal?
No.
I mean, you know that this guy is 100% clearly involved. If you're going to point the finger at one of these two guys, I really think the fact that it couldn't be pointed in Ricky's direction, they had to take Ricky as the guy that was doing the finger pointing.
Absolutely.
Because without that, you have a whole bunch of circumstantial evidence. But, I mean, you need to have some kind of a witness, somebody that says that it was this person. So, to me, I think that the plea deal was a joke. I mean, I feel terrible for that prisoner that was killed, but I'm also glad on the silver lining note that that guy is never getting out of jail now. Like, he's on death row. He's coming up in a couple years. It's going to be what it's going to be.
But we'll have to update that one.
Yeah. Yep. When he gets there, we'll make sure we mention it, but I'm not going to give him any more credence or any
What's
more time on
the show.
What's
his last name? Ricky what?
Pianata. I probably didn't say it right, but he's easy enough to find.
Out of Alabama? Is that what you said?
Gadsden. Yep. Alabama. I mean, the elephant in the room on this is, given the information that we could find through this, obviously I don't have the police files to go through, you know, to see if there was anything else that was mitigating. You know, I'm going off of all of the court's notes, stuff like that, that's easily findable online that you can do some research on your own. Do you think Nelson should have been executed for this?
No. I don't think there's enough evidence. He's not enough evidence. I think all it was circumstantial evidence.
Right.
From the air quotes witness
mm-hmm.
that helped in the crime.
Right.
But we know there was another guy.
Right.
But who is that?
We know that there's another guy because of Brian's testimony.
He,
exactly.
He doesn't fit. Nelson doesn't fit this description at all.
He doesn't fit anything. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, I can't find anything that says that they found blood on, if they would have found blood on his shoe that they said matched the crime scene. I mean, that would have been easily discernible, right? And you know, from blood spatter, it don't take much to find blood.
No.
Especially when you're shooting four people a total of 12 times. I mean, there's going to be some blood around someplace, especially if you step in it, it's going to get into the pores of your shoes.
Yeah, lots of it. Yeah.
I mean, right? Yeah. I mean, I know that this was 1994, but this execution wasn't until 3 years ago. I mean, it's not like they never had a chance to check anything again.
Yeah, they definitely had some high-tech forensics they could have rolled on that.
It's just a really low bar, I think, for what it takes to get an execution. I mean, I get it. In a situation like this, to where you have three people that are dead and another one whose life has been changed forever for no reason at all, for $2,100 or the idea that you might get caught, I mean, you're going to want some justice for something like that.
Absolutely.
But you got to make sure it's the right person and the right justice.
The more I hear about our justice system, the more I feel it fails more than it succeeds.
I feel like it fails because we find where it fails. I think that it's easy like that. Like, it's easy to find the blemishes. I feel like our system is pretty good, but when it fails, like, it fails pretty fucking hard sometimes.
Hard, yeah. Maybe that's the best, better synopsis of it all.
So let me ask this question then. What could they have done with Nelson in this? If you think that he's involved, you don't have the direct hard evidence. You have him with Ricky in the car after it's all said and done. I mean, can you get him with an accessory after the fact, aiding and abetting, harboring a fugitive? I mean, I'm trying to think of things that you could actually hit this guy with to where if you think he's involved on some level, you can't execute him unless you got proof. I mean, clearly you can, but you shouldn't. But can you get this guy for anything? Or do you think that he should have walked based on what we know? Somebody could send us an email to the show and say, hey, these 11 points, none of these are brought up. You're missing every single one of these.
If I can't see this guy getting any more than 5 years.
Right.
As a close acquaintance.
Right. As an accessory after the fact.
Yeah. I mean, you have no proof on him. But if you kind of think he did it, you can't give him more than 5 years. You have nothing.
I mean, there's been plenty of people in this world that I believe have walked on a lack of evidence. Doesn't mean that the whole world doesn't think that they did it. It just means that you can't prove it in court.
O.J. Simpson.
Right. I mean, O.J. ain't the only one. There's a lot of O.J.'s out there.
I know, but everybody in the world thought O.J. did it.
Right.
And he walked.
That's crazy.
But this guy gets the death penalty.
Yeah.
For quite possibly not even being there.
Yeah. So, now, one of the things that is strange that I struggled with a little bit is, you ever remember something and, like, you have an idea of, like, grandeur that it was? Or, like, I believe that the human memory is something that you almost sharpen to your own narrative sometimes.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
100%.
Like, especially if you're going to tell a story about what it was, you have to organize it and be able to tell it, right? Down the road later, Bryant said, you know, after a long time of evaluation and thinking about it, I could have been off on the height by a couple of inches, you know, and that easily could have been the voice. They played so many of them for me. It could have been any one of them. You know, I'm post-surgery at this point, you know. It literally could have been anything, you know, to where he thinks that they have the right guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to where I thought that was really interesting.
He thought Nelson could have been him.
Yeah. After enough time had gone by, he came back and said later, hey, I think that it might have been him, honestly, but no proof at all to back that up. I mean, couldn't come up with anything that would be significant. They couldn't get from the description of clothing, nothing like that came through to where there was something they could have been like, oh, he had a red sweatshirt on with a gray hood, you know what I mean? And had a torn sleeve on the left-hand side. There was nothing like that that they were able to recover to tie back to him. So,
well, I guess that makes me feel a little bit more easy at ease that the guy that got shot 5 times come back and said, you know what? They very easily could have been him.
Yeah.
I mean,
it makes it a hard case.
Yeah.
I mean, it's coming down to the use of basically memories and the littlest tiny bit of evidence. I think this is the least amount of evidence we've seen in one of these cases, to be completely honest.
It's pretty bad.
Right, to where there's just no proof at all that he ever fired that gun, even if he was there. And even if they bring him up on the same charges because he was part of the crime that was being committed while that happened.
I mean,
I don't know if you can say that it's him.
I got to say, because of the fingerprints not matching up with Nelson, it's not him. I'm sorry.
I mean, right. Unless he had gloves on.
That's but you're it, not leaving it. Fingerprints. They said there was another set of prints that they could not say was him or wasn't him. Well, I'm sorry. If it's not him, it's not him.
Right. It's not him unless it is him.
Right.
Yeah.
So how can you say, well, we couldn't tell either way? No, you can. There's prints. So if those prints don't match, it's not your guy.
Right.
They wanted it to be him. They needed to close this case.
Yep.
They had a lot of pressure to close this case,
right?
And they did. So I'm going to go back now to it's not Nelson, based on the prints.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one that's always going to be up for debate, and I don't think that we should be executing people when it's up for debate.
Absolutely.
Worst case scenario is he gets a commuted life sentence.
I mean, anybody that has listened to any of our shows, whether it's the Harper or the Gallows, knows that we are pro-death penalty. But we are
when appropriate.
Well, we are not pro-killing somebody when you're not 100% sure they did it.
Exactly. When there's no question of who did it and that it happened,
we've
got to be eradicated.
We've talked about having death prison island, and we've said you can only put people on there that have 100% bona fide murderers.
Right. It's crazy.
This guy is not one of those.
Right. So I think this is a simple answer for the final question of the show. Was justice served in this case?
Well, I'm going to have to say no.
I'm going to say no for Nelson. I'm glad that in the end, Ricky's going to end up meeting his maker. So
yeah, he's guilty of sin.
It's a 50-50 proposition for me. Yes on one side, no on the other. So that is the case of the execution of Mr. Nelson. Thank you guys so much for joining us tonight. As always, please check out our Patreon if you want to get a couple extra episodes in. It's always a good time. We've got a couple of them up there for you right now.
And they are some good, good stuff.
They really are. And if you or somebody you know and love is dealing with any kind of substance abuse, physical abuse, mental illness of any kind, if you're afraid of hurting yourself or somebody else, please call the National Mental Health Hotline, 1-800-622-4357. Somebody on the other end of that line will help you.
Please make the call and stay safe.